So my name is David Livingston. I'm an independent researcher. I did start going to university for a few years, but I soon recognized that it's what I called an institution of higher indoctrination. There's a lot of information available there, but it's not possible to follow the facts where they lead. The opposite is the purpose. The purpose is to ensure that you don't connect the dots. We basically want you to regurgitate the status quo agenda. So I've been studying on my own ever since, about 35 years now. I've written 5 books. My latest is a 6-volume set, which is called Ordo Ab Cal. And basically, all this time is I'm trying to understand, at least to what we're going to talk about, I'm trying to understand what's happening now. And the only way to understand what's happening now is to understand the agenda and the motivations. And for that, you got to understand what are the beliefs of those who shape that agenda. And really, it's based on a belief system that goes back a couple of thousand years. And it's possible to trace it that far back, follow along in all those years of who was responsible for maintaining it, how they influenced each other, how it developed, to actually understand, you know, at least better understand what's going on today.
Well, look, I mean, you've put me in mind of one of my favorite Eton College students. That's George Orwell, when he talks about he who controls the present controls the past. He who controls the past controls the future. Exactly. And so what you seem to be saying is that there's quite a lot of effort, even at the universities, to hold down that analysis.
Absolutely. There's a fascinating book on the subject, particularly the American system. It's a Marxist perspective, but it's really good. It's called Universities in the Capitalist State by Clyde Barrow, and he details how the university system was appropriated by a number of foundations, but leading among them, of course, the Rockefeller Foundation, which, you know, is the foundation that basically shaped the United States in the 20th century. But basically, they took a university system across the United States, which was decentralized, without any kind of standards, and through their funding of board of trustees, they helped sort of recruit these various universities' agenda. They helped them to shape their faculties, their teaching methods, their teaching content, and then through what's called the Board of Education. The main Board of Education in the United States is basically how they've been managing their control. And then, you know, through various other means, they managed to effectively control, monitor the type of education that they communicate. In fact, you know what they did? This is really, really important. So what they did is that, especially after World War I, they created what's called the Western Civilization Course. And there's an article on this this is a scholarly academic article by, I think it's Richard Allardyce, Allardyce something. And it shows how the Rockefeller Foundation created this so-called Western Civilization Course, or what they call the Great Books Course. And it's a Hegelian version of history. So it's a version of history that teaches that Western civilization has progressed since Greece. It's a natural, spontaneous evolution towards secularism. So that, you know, free thought began in Greece and evolved through the Renaissance and Enlightenment and culminated into this wonderful product that we called liberal democracy. And so that's effective. The purpose of it at the time was to justify America's involvement in World War I, because that was the main holdup at the time, is that it had been a challenge to try to get America involved. So by promoting the idea that America was actually part of a larger Western civilization and with a duty to come to the defense of democracy wherever it was threatened. And so effectively, as you can see, as you know, that's the lie that has been taught. And this is what happened to me, is that I went to a college in Concordia in Montreal here. It's called the liberal arts. It was a college within a university, and it was called the Liberal Arts College. And the purpose of it, strangely enough, was to revive the Western civilization course, to give like a more traditional, what they call liberal arts education. So when I got to, you know, when they began to try to indoctrinate me into this nonsense about so-called Western version of history, a lot of points of it really didn't make any sense. So I wanted to try to understand where this idea was coming from, and if it was wrong, how was it wrong, and how do I find out the truth? And I'm still at it. So that's what I started when I was, you know, about 35 years ago. And that's really what spurred me to study what I have and to produce what I have.
Well, you've reminded me of a chap called Norman Dodd as well, because he's quite famously
talked about foundations.
Yeah, he talked about the way that the Carnegie Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, this is mainly after the Second World War, they adopted a specific program. Remember, of course, these people don't pay any tax. They are there to apparently educate people like a charity. Right. The only thing is that they've got a very, very political agenda. Yep. Which is, what he was talking about, Norman was talking about, was because he actually worked in with these people.
Yes, he did.
And he explained that they had decided that they were going to create, for all the main faculties, he started off by discussing the faculties of economics, that they were going to fund and actually educate, if you can call it that, a kind of not hypnosis, but to let these people realize that there was a rather wonderful gravy train here that they could get on if they wanted to.
Right.
To fund what he described as a stable of economists who would start to dominate the whole of. It's amazing to think, really, that they were adopting a method there. For a start, to dominate university education on these enormous subjects in the United States, and then, of course, the rest of the Western world.
The rest of the world, exactly. So, no, that's the other book that goes into the detail, explains exactly what's going on. And that's why the book is called Tax-Exempt Foundations, and that what's important to note there is that's exactly what happened, right? What happened is that John D. Rockefeller was perceived for being the scoundrel that he was, and so he, his company was broken up through the Sherman Antitrust regulations, which broke up, Standard Oil was one of the pieces, I guess.
That's right. This was around the time of the First World War.
Yes. And so what he did is that he bought back his reputation by funding all these quote unquote charities. But what he was, of course, doing was using his money for political methods, but getting away with not even paying any taxes so he could use even more of his funds for his devious deeds. So what's important now is that his grandson, David Rockefeller, who was the head of the Rockefeller Foundation. So two things I wanted to point out is that in the 20th century, first of all, the Rockefeller family, a large part of their funds come from Saudi Arabia, right? Which is, I think, a third of the world's oil resources. First established there in 1933 with the help of the Saudis and British shenanigans. And so, and ever since that time, there are two fronts that were used by the CIA to cover for their activities, and that's the Ford Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation. And now, and secondly, Bill Gates has admitted he was friends with David Rockefeller and looked at him as a mentor and modeled his career on him. And so this is why you see that Bill Gates did, which the irony is that Bill Gates was he was charged under the same Sherman antitrust rules that David's grandfather was, and that with his reputation destroyed, Bill Gates did the same thing, started these immense charities to make it seem like he's some kind of wonderful philanthropist, when, of course, he's pushing through the same agenda as all his cronies have been doing all along.
Yeah, and there's also the link with the Rockefeller family to Zionism. One of the people I interviewed years ago was his name was John Loftus, who was a special prosecutor appointed by Jimmy Carter. He wrote a book called The War Against the Jews. And he explained that the vote in 1948 at the United Nations was a very it was extremely dicey as to whether Israel were going to vote for the Israeli state. And Nelson Rockefeller was instrumental in getting the South American countries and Central American countries, the newly founded United Nations, to vote for this Israeli state. There were lots of concerns about it. But Nelson apparently said to David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, that that you can either have a country or vengeance, but not both. And so the idea was that you had to give up on pursuing the Nazi war criminals if you wanted to get your country. So this Rockefeller family, very, very much involved with the creation of the Israeli state, which I'd like to talk about in a minute. But I think it's probably better, if you don't mind, to start chronologically and go right the way back to things like the Kabbalah. And things like the Zohar and these influences, because there is this whole idea of Jewish mysticism, which most Orthodox Jews completely reject, but which has been kind of carrying on in the background. In fact, you might even say in the foreground.
Yeah, so that's going a lot far, it's pretty far back. So, so let's say there's a specific strain of Kabbalah we need to look at. So Kabbalah, of course, is a set of mystical doctrines. They can feature, this is what I've been, really the core aspect of my research has been trying to pinpoint exactly when they emerged, and I pinpoint that to the 6th century BC in Babylon. So, I mean, and so there's really this history, right? So we can summarize it in a few minutes. So basically, God asks Abraham to sacrifice his child. In the Bible, it's Isaac. But at the last second, he is saved by an angel and asked to sacrifice a lamb instead. And because of his devotion, God makes a promise with him. He asks him to look out, and all the land that he can see will be inherited by his descendants. It will be many. So Isaac has a son named Jacob, who's later named Israel, who has 12 sons. They end up in Egypt, and they are there for, according to the Bible, approximately 400 years. And then they are rescued by Moses, who brings them back to the Holy Land. There eventually, what happens, you have a series of, well, the first problem that happens is that when they are commanded to conquer, according to the Bible, conquer the land of Palestine, and this is the justification that the Zionists are using to basically slaughter the inhabitants and to remove them, that they were warned that to avoid falling into the worship of the gods of those people. The idea was that they were God's chosen people, and God basically said to them, you know, he chose them above all the nations, that they, you know, of all the qualities that they had, that if they, all they had to do was follow the Ten Commandments, they would be examples for humanity, and the whole world would regard them as leaders. But I'll get to this point later, is how they bastardized that idea. So basically what happens is that they enter Canaan, and within a very short time, they start practicing the cult of the Canaanites, which is the worship of Baal and Astarte, which also includes elements like astrology and magic and things like that. Well, actually, that came later. But anyway, so the story of the Bible from the time of the Exodus to the captivity is the story of various prophets being constantly sent to try to reform the Jews, to return to the true religion, to the worship of Yahweh, God, and to the practice of the adherence to the Ten Commandments. But they don't. It's basically, you know, as a whole, it's a culture that had completely veered away from Judaism. Even the temple itself, so it'd be like the equivalent of the Vatican becoming a pagan temple. the Temple of Solomon itself was turned into a pagan temple. And so the warnings came several times that if they continued those ways, they would be taken into captivity. So what happens in 6597? The Babylonians come. Before that, what happens is that the Assyrians come and they conquer the northern kingdom of Israel and send those people off into captivity. They become, you know, from that point forward, the lost tribes. The lower kingdom of Judah is conquered again, I said, in 597. They are taken into captivity in Babylon. And this is where they come in contact with the teachings of the ancient Magi, known to the world as ancient Magi. But basically what happens is that they come into contact with the teachings of astrology and numerology and magic, which they incorporate with their religion of Baal. But now, instead of practicing their cult outwardly, they turn it into, they disguise it as a mystical interpretation of Judaism, which becomes the Kabbalah. And so they, how the Kabbalah is effectively, it's a Gnostic version of Judaism. So it reverses everything. So where God becomes bad and the devil becomes good. The devil becomes the liberator of humanity. And so they follow the same tire, sort of, you know, the whole basic teachings and expectations of the end times, with the expectations of a prophet to come to install them, to gather them back and to lead them from Jerusalem. But they see it in reverse. So the first thing that happens is that Cyrus conquers, I think in 538 BC, and allows the Jews to return to Palestine, where they rebuild the temple. This becomes now the second temple. That temple then is finally destroyed in 70 AD by the Romans, and that's the end. And then this is the beginning of the diaspora, when the Jews are required to live in exile all this time. And ever since that time, the majority of Jews have been still hoping for the coming of their Messiah and their return to Zion, or the Holy Land. The problem is that within the Jewish community, you have a certain group, more radical wing, who are followers of the Kabbalah, who have a more distorted view of it. And this is where you get the idea that, so according to the mystical teachings of the Kabbalah, the Jews are the chosen people. But what that means effectively is that they are, history is laid out for their purpose, and that non-Jews are expendable and effectively not human. So
now I've got to stop you there, because this is sounding a little bit too much to me the Nazi idea of the master race, the Aryans, and you know, putting down the Slavs, putting down the Gypsies, putting down the Jews, etc.
Yes. Well, now that's where we're getting to. where we want to start? So basically, you have like the most important development of Kabbalah is the Kabbalah of Isaac Luria, which is developed in the 1500s. And so this is a key aspect of the Kabbalah. And so this is why I'm trying to find the book that describes this. But it's an excellent book that's critical of Israel, and it traces basically the racism of a segment of right-wing Zionism to the Kabbalah. And it shows that typically in Halakha, when a Jew converts to Judaism, he's considered a Jew. But for Kabbalists, they don't. For the Kabbalists, you're a Jew by race. And so this is important, because what happens is that the Kabbalah of Isaac Luria inspires the mission of Shabtai Zvi, who declares himself Messiah in 1666. This is a mission which is effectively coordinated by a man named Manasseh ben Israel, who's headquartered in Amsterdam, and he's surrounded by these various Rosicrucians called the Hartlib Circle, which is Samuel Hartlib, John Dury, and Comenius. And they help him communicate with Oliver Cromwell to get Cromwell to allow the Jews to return to England, because they were banned from entry since 1290 by Edward I. So that happens. And what happens then is that the first synagogue is established in London, which is called Bevis Marks. And it's basically the run by Sabbateans or followers of Shabbatai Zvi. About 100 years later, in the mid-1700s, you get the successor of Shabbatai Zvi. His name is Jacob Frank. He openly claims to be a reincarnation of Shabbatai Zvi. And he teaches, so now I can tell you, refer to you with somebody like Gershom Shalom, who is really the world-renowned expert on this subject. And he shows that the Frankists followed a religion of what you called religious nihilism. And effectively, they believe that the Messiah wouldn't return until the world had become completely rotten. So they had to assist in sowing as much chaos as possible. Because they rejected the Bible in favor of the Zohar. In fact, if you go back to the teaching of Shabbatai Zvi, he taught that with the arrival of the Messiah, the laws of the Bible are no longer applicable, which is why the Sabbateans were known for practicing orgies that involved incest and adultery. So these same practices then, of course, were repeated by Jacob Frank. One of his important successors, because Jacob Frank's cousin is known Moses Dobruska, he founded an organization called the Asiatic Brethren. And so their members were closely affiliated with Moses Mendelssohn. And I've talked about this before, but there's Rabbi Antelman who's written a great book about the survival of Sabbateanism and Judaism and its subversion of Judaism, called two volumes called To Eliminate the Opiate. And he found in a library in New York a list of ordination that showed a list of the successors, the ordained successors of Shabbatai Zvi, and Moses Mendelssohn was the last at that time, because it's a list that was preserved by his friend Nikolai, who was the publisher for the Illuminati. Mendelssohn wasn't a member of the Illuminati himself, but he had several friends who were like Gottfried Lessing and a whole network. And so Moses Mendelssohn was a promoter of what's called Haskalah, which was to promote the Jews to get out, so-called, quote-unquote, out of the ghetto. So until that point, Jews had been living largely secluded in their communities where they followed Jewish traditions. But people like Mendelssohn, he was also a follower of Spinoza, who was the student of Manasseh ben Israel, who had been excommunicated. And this is important because a lot of people forget that Judaism is a religion. And at one point before the Zionists came along, it was possible to be excommunicated from it. You're Jewish if you follow Judaism, regardless of, you know, if you convert or not, and you are no longer Jewish if you stop practicing. And so Spinoza was excommunicated for his heresy because Spinoza is celebrated, of course, these days, especially, you know, if you've suffered from Western indoctrination in their universities. He's sort of celebrated as, you know, the first secular Jew, one of the first to sort of, you know, begin Bible criticism. But he effectively explained that, you know, I can't remember the details, but basically something to the effect that, you know, the rules of Judaism are just applicable to, it's more of a national standard, and it's not really necessary to follow it. So this is kind of what Mendelssohn was proposing, and this is why he promoted the assimilation of Jews into German society. So basically, they would throw off their, you know, kaftans and their curls and their hats, and they would basically put on suits and become lawyers and doctors and become indistinguishable from the rest of the community. And that was his response to the Jewish question. So this is where it gets interesting. His daughter was Dorothea Mendelssohn, and she was married to Friedrich Schlegel, who is the man, the European scholar, historian, who coined the term Aryan race. So when you look at the term Aryan, the whole idea of the Aryan race is a Kabbalistic idea. It's not expressed that way openly, but there's enough hints in the language when you look at how what the Aryan race was referred to, but they're typically identified as descendants of Cain, who had survived the flood of Atlantis. They were descendants of the sons of God of the Bible, who were supposedly these giants who lived before the flood. they survived Atlantis, and then they landed in the mountains of Asia, or specifically the Caucasus, and then spread out through India and to Europe, which is why they're referred to as the Indo-Europeans. So it's important to remember at this point now that the Kabbalah, that the Inner-Aryan race was a Kabbalistic idea. And this is how it was picked up later by the occult revival. So the Asiatic Brethren, which was founded again by Jacob Frank's cousin, Moses Dobruska, became the core influence behind what's called the occult revival. They were also affiliated with what's called the Frankfurt Juden Lodge, which was set up by members of the Asiatic Brethren. What's interesting is that the Grand Master of the Asiatic Brethren was Prince Charles of Hessen-Kessel. And he was from a family that had, he was a descendant of what's called the alchemical wedding. So when the Rosicrucian movement emerged, it was centered around the marriage of Frederick V of the Palatinate and Elizabeth Stuart, the daughter of King James. And it was celebrated in a Rosicrucian book called the Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosicrucians, which means an alchemical wedding. And so, you know, what they tried to do is that they tried to offer the crown to the crown of Bohemia to Frederick. That triggered the Habsburgs to put a stop to it and ignited the 30 Years' War. So the Rosicrucian movement was effectively dispersed. This is how they ended up in London, working with Manasseh ben Israel. But what happened is that even though they lost, their grandson was George I. And then ever since then, the royal family of England has been governed, ruled by the monarchs who are descended from this alchemical wedding. So there's several people, important people who are descended from that alchemical wedding. The other one is Frederick II, the Frederick the Great of Prussia, who was Grand Master of Scottish Rite Freemasonry, but also this Prince Charles of Hessen-Kessel, who was the Grand Master of the Asiatic Brethren. So according to the name of this researcher, he's a Dutch researcher, he looked at the family archive and he discovered that Prince Charles of Hessen-Kessel was the one who introduced the swastika as the symbol of the Asiatic Brethren alongside the Star of David, which had been introduced by Moses Dobruska. Both symbols became, you know, core symbols of the Asiatic Brethren. The Star of David, of course, is not a Jewish symbol. It's a magical symbol from the practical Kabbalah of the Middle Ages, which then became identified falsely as the Seal of Solomon. And the swastika, the reason it was adopted is because it was an Indian symbol that was believed to be a hallmark of the survival of the Aryans. And in this case, they thought it was a representative of reincarnation, which is found in Buddhism, which was similar to a belief called Gilgul from the Kabbalah, which also has a kind of belief in reincarnation.
It does seem as if official Judaism, if there's such a thing, has kind of completely lost control. And these heresies are just taking off
left and
center.
Yes.
But I mean, you're talking about the Star of David there, these two triangles, one superimposed upon another. This has become obviously a massive symbol now on the Israeli flag, etc. But it's not quite the same as the Seal of Solomon, is it? Which I think is something like is it a 9 or 12 pointed object, which it's similar, but there's a lot more sides to it. And the Seal of Solomon was supposed to have been associated with John Dee, who was the advisor to Elizabeth I and one of the originators of the British Empire back in the 1500s.
Right. Well, I mean, there is no Seal of Solomon, but the idea is it comes from the legend that Solomon had was granted the power to employ demons, spirits, in Islam they're called jinn, to assist him in building the temple. And so he had a ring which had a seal on it, which is what apparently gave him power over these entities. And so this craft, witchcraft, is sort of supposed to be the craft of Freemasonry. And this is why Masons allegorically are trying to rebuild the Temple of Solomon by using the craft and the Seal of Solomon, which is control over entities, to rebuild the the temple, which is an allegory for building effectively, you know, sorry for the cliche, but a new world order.
Yeah, well, this temple, it's quite interesting the way that the Masons revere Solomon, but not David. I mean, David was an exemplary king, whereas Solomon was a very much a fallen king. But anyway, look, let's get back to Zionism and its origins.
Yep.
Because a lot of what you're saying is almost leading up to people like Lord Palmerston, who wasn't a Jew. He was one of the first people in his papers after his death. It was discovered that he'd been saying, hey, the Jews desire to move to Palestine. Well, the Jews had not actually been even asked by Palmerston, but he decided that that's where they wanted to go. And then, of course, we've got Theodor Herzl and the much more formalized international Zionist congresses in the late 1800s.
Yes, but it does start because what was happening around Palmerston is there was a lot of moves in the secret societies towards that end, particularly the Carbonari, who were headed by Giuseppe Mazzini, who by some accounts was the successor of Adam Weishaupt. But he was working with a guy who was the ultimate intriguer. His name is Filippo Buonarroti, who was a member of the Illuminati. And so this is when they started to work towards effectively what were like proto-Zionist goals, but at the time fomenting various revolutions, particularly the revolutions of the Year of Revolutions of 1848, and through the communist movement. So an admirer of Buonarroti was Karl Marx, who of course was a Rothschild agent. The Rothschilds are key here. They're really kind of the family behind all of this stuff. They have immense connections all over the place to the Illuminati. They have connections especially to the Asiatic Brethren. They were backers of the Juden Lodge. The more important organization here is called the Alliance Israélite Universelle, the Universal Israelite Alliance. And this was founded by Adolf Kramer, who was the Grand Master of French Freemasonry, particularly of the Rite of Memphis. Mite of Mizraim. And so this is where it gets really interesting. So his protege was a guy named Maurice Joly. And Maurice Joly wrote the book, I can't remember, Dialogues Between Montesquieu and Machiavelli or something like that. And it's, according to Alan Bellis, in the 1920s, long before he became head of the CIA, he communicated to the London Times that, hey, he said he thinks he found the source of the protocols. And he claimed that it was forged. It was a forgery, plagiarized from Joly's book. But what they don't tell you is that Joly was a member of the lodge of the Memphis of the Mizraim Lodge with Kramer. And what's interesting is that Sergei Nihilus is the guy who first received a copy of the protocols before he translated it to Russian in 1901, I think. And he received it from a woman named Yuliana Glinka, and she had received it in turn from somebody who pulled it from Joly's Mizraim Lodge. But Yuliana Glinka was a protege of H.B. Blavatsky. And so now we're getting back to the whole wasp nest that produced the protocols is really fascinating. So it's a circle that incorporates not only Blavatsky, but also Pepys, who was, one of the leading occultists of his time. And another guy who's very fascinating was W.T. Stead, William T. Stead, who was a famous British journalist at the time. And so first of all, you get back to Blavatsky. So Blavatsky was the first important development at least in the occult of the theory of the development of her versions of the theories of the Aryan race. And so where the earlier scholars were, avoided overt associations with Atlantis, she basically laid it all out. And it's her ideas that influenced Nazis, particularly through two characters, Lance von Liebenfels and Guido von List. And their doctrines are called Ariosophy. So, in fact, maybe we can back up a little bit. Where I think the character who seems to have really been responsible for this strategy, which is basically of, is Richard Wagner. So Wagner, it's interesting. He married Cosima, the daughter of Franz Liszt, and I can't remember her name, Madame Dagoux or something like that, who was involved closely with the entire, she was friends with Mazzini. She was involved in the entire network of the Carbonari. And even Marx used to visit her salons as well. And Wagner and Cosima also had their own networks of friendships with former members of the Carbonari. In fact, Wagner was involved in the revolutions of 1848 and collaborated with Bakunin, who was an avowed Satanist. So this is despite the fact, so of course, Wagner becomes buddies with Nietzsche, very much inspires him, becomes his idol. Nietzsche, though, even suspects that Wagner is Jewish. This is despite the fact, of course, that Wagner was an open anti-Semite. So this is where we get to understand that, you know, what we're talking about here is a Frankist tradition. You know, there's an excellent article written by an academic called, I think, Abraham Duker, about the Frankist movement. And what he shows is, you know, that the Frankists are effectively an anti-Semitic sect.
Because, well, I mean, you know, I think there's probably quite a lot of Jews in Israel right now wondering, you know, if the government is anti-Semitic, because it seems, yes, to be putting the entire future of their dream at, mm-hmm, at risk. But look, can I drag you back to Herzl and this creation? Because I mean, I think it's fascinating, because I was looking at the you know, the British clearing the Ottomans out of in the First World War in 1917 and 1918, only to find that the two big campaigns, the first one by Allenby in Gaza, finished with that week, the Balfour Declaration being published in London, and the same with the campaign of Megiddo in the south in Palestine, clearing the Ottomans right out, routing them and kicking them out of Palestine effectively. And once that had happened, the end of that week, we had a surrender signed by the Ottomans, and the World War One came to an end. So it's almost as if that First World War was a culmination of something which Herzl and the rest of them have been planning for a long time.
Yes, a long time. Yes. And it starts with Wagner. So Wagner, basically, his ideas, or he became really sort of the idol of the entire what's called pan-German and folkish movement. And folk is an idea which was developed by Gottfried Herder, who again was an admirer of Moses Mendelssohn. And there's basically a development of the idea of the Aryan race, where it goes back to the idea that the quality of a people is not determined in their culture, but in their race, right? So what makes, but it's racial identity is what defines the people, their traditions, their, you know, their location, their upbringing, not their upbringing, sorry, you know, mostly external factors, right? No free will. So this folk idea basically inspired this folkish movement. We started to celebrate the virtues of the Aryan race in particular, and developed into this what's called this pan-German movement. One of the most important ideologue of the movement was a guy named George von Schernerer, who again was an admirer of Wagner. And so the pan-German folkish movement, particularly because he was an Austrian, so it was largely flourishing in Austria, which is where Hitler came from, and was spreading through a various number of basically university fraternities, One of them in particular was called the Albia Fraternity, and that's where Herzl got his start. So Herzl, before he started the, you know, founded the Zionist World Zionist Organization, or convened the Zionist Congress in 1897, was a member of this right-wing, folkish, pan-German, racist, proto-Nazi organization, which was connected to this von Schirnerer and expressing the very same ideas. Because even when you could look at a guy like von Schirnerer, he was Jewish, or secretly Jewish. Just like Wagner was, even Nietzsche, his best friend who inspired him was Paul Rey, who was Jewish. It's consistent that what you find, and this is what I wanted to explain, is that the Frankists are anti-Semitic. So, you know, like if I talked with, you know, my, let's say, you know, if I talk about Muslims, we would be critical of Muslims, but that doesn't make us anti-Muslim. And so the Frankists are critical of non-Frankist Muslims. And in fact, what Abraham Ducker suggests is that they are even sort of vengeful because of the persecutions that they were forced to endure as heretics. And so they've got this long-standing bitterness towards non-Jews, and eventually, which is, you know, extended from Zionists to non-Zionists. So, you know, especially what happened in Germany is that you have all these Jews that had assimilated, and so now they consider themselves superior to this flood of Eastern European Jews that started to come into Germany called the Ostjuden. And so this is why you look at the literature of the early Zionists and even Herzl himself. In fact, Herzl wrote this entire, it's called self-hatred, right, in the Jewish culture. He wrote this book, which is considered a classic of self-hatred, called Mauschel, which is a derogatory term for Jews, to refer to this, you know, these sort of uncouth Eastern Jews that were flooding into Germany, and they're basically an embarrassment to the efforts of the German Jews to try to rehabilitate their image. And so this is kind of where this dichotomy comes from, and this is where this, like, this is how it was affected, that you've had these Zionists who were working within the racist movements, who were expressing anti-Semitic or promoting anti-Semitic sentiments directed towards, effectively, Jews who were traditional Jews, normal Jews, you know, people who practiced Judaism, because this is exactly what they were opposed to. It's something that they were trying to subvert. So that is effectively it. So this is why, you know, what's interesting, I want to come back to, is that when the Balfour Declaration was written, it was written to addressed to Lord Walter Rothschild, right? But he was asked to transmit it to the Zionist Federation of Great Britain. And the leader of the Zionist Federation was Joseph Cowan. And Joseph Cowan was a friend with the same network of ex-Carbonari that were connected to Wagner. And so when Herzl wanted to communicate with Cecil Rhodes, because he thought Cecil Rhodes would give him the backing that he needed to communicate with, he wanted to bribe Sultan Abdul Hamid, the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire. He reached out he reached out to Joseph Cowan to intercede through W.T. Stead. And this is how now we come back to the protocols of Zion. So effectively, you know, there's a fascinating, the documentary by an Israeli documentary filmmaker about the ADL called Defamation. And at one point, he interviews Abe Foxman, and Abe Foxman makes a really, really surprising admission, because the filmmaker interviews asks him, he says, he looks at Abe Foxman, who's just, you know, basically some schmuck from New York who gets invited to visit all these world leaders. And so Abe Foxman asks him, like, how was that possible? Like, why are they rolling out the red carpet for you? He said, let me put it like this. He said, the Jews are not as powerful as the Jews think they are, but not as powerful as the non-Jews think they are. said it's somewhere in between in his New York accent. And then he explains, he says, how do you fight the conspiratorial view of the Jews without exploiting it? And this is his own words, right? So anti-Semitism is necessary. It's part, it is the strategy, and it's a strategy that goes back to Wagner, is the need that the plan is to fulfill Bible prophecy of the return of the Jews to Palestine according to a perverted Kabbalistic interpretation of the Bible. And the ends justify the means. And so nothing is off the table. Any methods can be used. In fact, the more devious, the more outlandish, the more daring, the better. Because then you're proving, you know, your willingness to commit to this mission. And so that meant effectively infiltrating, first of all, not just promoting, but basically cultivating a racist right, because what they did, it wouldn't have existed otherwise. So basically Zionists created the racist movement in Austria, which that eventually Hitler came from, and then as a tool to gain favor for the Zionist cause and ultimately instill enough fear into the European Jews to force them to migrate to Israel. And that's how you can understand the Hitler movement.
Well, yeah, let's bring it up to date a bit more, though, because we've seen over the last month and a bit more the most horrific bombing attack on Gaza. I mean, this is an area which has been slowly isolated, turned into a prison camp, basically. And why is it, though, do you think that there is this such a strong enthusiasm for the Israelis from Britain and the United States? We've been having these massive marches in London, and yet the government, including the opposition, are refusing. They're saying, oh well, we can have a few humanitarian pauses, but no ceasefire. Actually, what's going on is we've got rather incredible war crimes going on in front of our eyes, with almost no pushback from the West at all. And you can imagine, can't you, if either the British Prime Minister or the US President were to say stop Israel, they would probably stop straight away.
Well, it's not going to happen, because effectively we've got working in the background Freemasonry and another order, which is the Bene Brith, which is basically sort of a quasi-Masonic Zionist version of Freemasonry. What's interesting is a friend of mine just happened to send me today by a French lecturer who's talking about agents of the Mossad, basically a branch of Mossad agents that are called Sayanim. And these are basically unpaid agents, effectively, not on the payroll, but who sort of volunteer to contribute to the Zionist cause. So you're looking to basically at, you know, this is how you explain people like Palmerston. Ms. Palmerston was working with Mazzini, right? In fact, Palmerston is effectively considered to have guided Mazzini. You have people like Lord Shaftesbury, who was the first one to make an open call for the return of Jews to Zion, to the land of Zion, Holy Land, working as well with Palmerston. You're basically looking at, this is why this is how the whole idea of this maintaining this idea of Jewish power is necessary, and this is why the protocols are necessary, because they use the perception of their power to their advantage, and I don't know if I'll be able to find it, but this is basically advice given by Chaim Weizmann, something to the effect that we're not as powerful as they think they are, we need to continue to let them think that. So, you know, what you can imagine is that many times you're looking at people like Lord Balfour, another member of the Round Table. These are, you know, the thing is that the Zionists have the Rothschilds as their chief backers. So, we don't hear about it, but likely what happens is that, countries are threatened like Britain in particular, would have been threatened that either they're offered favors or they're offered threats that the Rothschilds would be able to effect with the power at their control. You know, like there's a famous line, I haven't been able to substantiate it, but something to the effect where Rothschild said, you know, I don't care what puppet rules as long as I've got control of the money, the money supply. And so they can ease, they pull the levers, so they're able to easily make threats or promises that are powerful enough to induce, you know, whatever country to do their bidding.
Well, that's right. I mean, someone like Gordon Brown, you know, in 2008 being told, you know, either you're going to give the banking system a massive bailout or else the whole lot's going to come crashing down. Well, he does exactly what he's told.
Tough choice. Yeah.
Well, look, finally, David, fascinating insight into how we got here. From what you know and from your reading of their plans, effectively, yeah. Whereabouts is this all heading? What's the object of it all?
Let me read exactly what Ben-Gurion said in fascinating. He says it all. He said that it's in a speech in 1962. Okay, so he basically said, he shared his vision for the future. He said, the image of the world in 1987 has traced in my imagination, colon, the Cold War will be a thing of the past. Internal pressure of the constantly growing intelligentsia in Russia for more freedom and the pressure of the masses for raising their standard of living may lead to a gradual democratization of the Soviet Union. On the other hand, the increasing influence of the workers and farmers and the rising political importance of men of science may transform the United States into a welfare state with a planned economy. Western and Eastern Europe will become a federation of autonomous states having a socialist and democratic regime, with the exception of the USSR as a federated Eurasian state. All other continents will become united in a world alliance, at whose disposal will be an international police force. All armies will be abolished, and there will be no more wars. In Jerusalem, the United Nations, in brackets, a truly United Nations, will build a shrine of the prophets to serve the federated union of all continents. This will be the seat of the Supreme Court of mankind, to settle all controversies among the federated continents, as prophesied by Isaiah.
I mean, it looks like we're heading for a much more chaotic version than Ben-Gurion was prophesying there.
Well, it's, yeah, well, sure. So, you know, the some of the political background is a little off, but the point there is that it's a United Nations with a seat in Israel as fulfillment of Bible prophecy. Okay? So this is what they've been working on for 2,000 years. Right? You know, in at least this one group who have their particular Kabbalistic interpretation, they're trying to fulfill Bible prophecy, which they believe claims that they will be. In fact, you know, I took a course in Hebrew Bible at university by it was taught by a Jewish rabbi. And he basically tried to, you know, it took me a while to realize that he was trying to teach us that the covenant was the underlying theme of the Old Testament. And finally I asked him, okay, well, then what's the point? He said, well, he said, in the end, said, the Messiah will return and the Jews will rule the world in peace. No, it's a fundamental Zionist belief. So this is what they're, I don't know why, I assume this is obvious to most people, but that's what they're, that's what they're working for. They want to rebuild the third temple, right? They're working to the whole point of Zionism is to return the Jews to Israel as a fulfillment of Bible prophecy to establish Jerusalem as the seat of a world government.
Well, I mean, I think the trouble is they're not really carrying the rest of the world with them. They seem to be hell bent on doing this, no matter how many people they kill along the wayside. Anyway, David, do you think just let people know where they can get hold of your books?
Yeah. So I've got a website, which is ordoabcao.ca. That's my main website, which I keep most of my material. I find links to my books there. My latest book is entirely available online as web pages.
Okay, David. And I'll just finish. Well, look, I mean, I said I've finished about three times now, but just to read this quote from Sax Rohmer, who many people will know, was in the Golden Dawn with good old Aleister Crowley. He lived in Reigate, actually. His house is still there. I remember chatting to somebody who was just walking into the house saying, did you know this is Sax Roma's house? Oh, yes, a couple of years ago. Anyway, this is a quote of his. He says, my power, this is talking about Fu Manchu, he's the novelist. My power rests in the east, but my hand is stretched out to the west. I shall restore the lost grandeur of China when your civilization, as you're pleased to term it, has exterminated itself, when you've reduced to ashes your palaces and your temples, when in your blindness you have set back the clock which so laboriously you fashioned. I shall stir out of the fire, I shall rise. The red dusk of the west will have fallen, the golden dawn of the east will come. Anyway, so that's his take on it.
Okay.
Anyway, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Okay. Thanks.
Cheers, David. Bye. Okay, bye.